It's time for Northwestern Outdoors Radio, the show focusing on fishing, hunting, outdoor recreation, destinations, and conservation in the region where you live and play. Northwestern Outdoors is brought to you by Max Lure Company, Sportsman's Warehouse, and Wallowa County. And now, let's see what's going on in the field and on the water with your host, John Cruz.
You know that old phrase they say to actors and actresses going on stage, break a leg? Well, I'm never going to wish that on anyone ever again. Having suffered a broken leg a couple of weeks ago while walking my not-so-trusty Springer Spaniel, Georgia, I can tell you this isn't a whole lot of fun. I had surgery for it a week ago, and what I thought was going to be one screw and a small metal plate connecting my fibula back to my ankle joint turned out to be 11 screws and a long metal plate to put things back together. It's been a little painful, I will admit. Thank God for the wonders of modern medicine and medication, that has certainly helped, but the fact of the matter is, I'm going to be off my left foot for a good 8 weeks, which means my hunting season and fall fishing season, well, they're pretty well shot. I'd like to thank everybody who sent me well wishes, I truly appreciate it. I also covet your prayers for quick healing too, and as for all of you who are on two good legs, be careful out there. You don't want to break one. Trust me on this. This week on Northwestern Outdoors Radio, well wishes are also needed for our iconic steelhead trout. We are looking at a very grim run of steelhead up the Columbia River. We are looking at the worst run of summer steelhead since 1938. It's that bad, folks. In fact, we are seeing closures and restrictions all up and down the Columbia Snake Rivers at this point, and I think more are to come. Unfortunately, this isn't a one-off. This isn't just a one-time thing. We've been seeing declines in our steelhead runs for years now, and that's why we're going to be talking to Josh Mills. Now, Josh and I don't always see eye to eye. He is a very well-known Northwest fly angler and conservationist and advocate for steelhead. He's a member of Backcountry Hunters and Anglers, and he's also on the board for the Wild Steelhead Coalition, but we do agree on a couple of things. Number one, we both love steelhead and steelhead fishing, and number two, we both want to save these fish. The differences come into how to go about doing it, so we're going to have a really wide-ranging discussion, taking up a good 20 minutes of our show today about these fish, why we love them, and throw out some ideas on maybe how we can save them, and I'd recommend that you give it a listen, and if you hear something you'd like, well, reach out to your local representatives and senators and ask them to get on board to save our fish, which are really in trouble right now. In addition to this, we'll be talking to Sarah Dorenzo with Wyoming Game and Fish. She's got the fall hunting forecast for the state of Wyoming, and whether you're after big game, upland birds, or waterfowl, you're going to want to hear what's happening in the cowboy state this year. It's a mixed bag, but overall, it looks pretty darn promising. On the fishing front, you might be a frustrated angler in terms of looking for flashers which have the right color. A lot of times they just don't. So what's an angler to do? Well, you can buy decals for those flashers. Max Lure sells them, and Bob Loomis will tell you more about that. On top of this, we've got our ever-popular Sportsman's Warehouse Trivia Question of the Week. And you put all that together, we've got another great show coming your way. So let's kick it off, as we always do, with another edition of Sportsman Spotlight.
Valley Vet's Amy Robinson with some nutritional tips for horses. David Sparks, Sportsman Spotlight.
Dr. Jimmy Nichols, it was interesting to hear from her how horses' diet have and have not changed since the introduction of cereal grains into equine nutrition. So 1821 would have been whenever cereal grains were introduced to a horse's diet. And at that point in time, they had horses that were working really long hours out in the field. And for all of those hours in the field, they're expending a lot of calories, and therefore they needed a lot more calories back in their diet. So that's why people back at that time decided this is a good idea, and it's something that we continue to do today. However, the horse's diet can change, because hundreds of years ago, these horses were working 10, 12, or 14 hours a day, but now we have horses that are maybe only working an hour a day, or whenever we as a rider have time to ride or work them. So they're spending a lot more time being idle in their stall, or in some cases, smaller paddocks. antibiotics, in a nutshell, I guess, how their diet has and hasn't changed in a sense. But Dr. Nichols talked about how some horses will benefit from supplements in addition to the grain that we're providing them on a daily basis. And especially those horses that are maybe having arthritis problems, or maybe they have gut health problems and they need those different minerals and vitamins to help them through whatever challenges they might be facing.
Keep that in mind for your hunting horses and pack horses.
Hi, I'm Tutu. At least that's what my grandkids call me. And my heart is breaking for these precious children who will be forced to endure masks once again this school year. And that's why I support Unmask Our Kids WA. Visit unmaskourkidswa.com and join their email list for resources, plus connect with all the others that share our concerns about the physical and mental health risks masks have when they're forced on our children. You know, I was surprised to learn that it doesn't have to be that way. According to the revised Code of Washington, local school boards have the discretionary powers to create policy. Unmask Our Kids is advocating for mask policy to be decided by parents in conjunction with their school board, never by the state. We encourage you to contact your local representative. Let's work to revoke the governor's emergency powers, because parents and grandparents know what's best for their children. At Unmask Our Kids WA, you'll find the resources plus science showing all the risks when children are masked. Where there is risk, there needs to be choice. UnmaskOurKidsWA.com.
David Sparks, Sportsman Spotlight.
The preceding ad does not necessarily reflect the opinion of Northwestern Outdoors Radio and is aired in conjunction with Sportsman Spotlight. You're back in with Northwestern Outdoors Radio. I'm John Cruz. Fall is upon us, and that means you're probably interested in how hunting's going to be this year. That's why we've got Sarah Dorenzo on the line. She's the Public Information Officer for Wyoming Game and Fish, and she's going to break down the statewide fall hunting forecast for us. And by the way, once we're done, because we're going to go over the highlights here, I would really encourage you to go to the Wyoming Game and Fish website. They've got the entire statewide forecast online for you to read. Sarah, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me again.
You know, a lot of folks outside of Wyoming are going to be very interested in this, because Wyoming is just such a destination for hunters, especially when it comes to big game. And I'd like to start off with the most popular big game animal that's hunted in Wyoming. And I understand that's the elk. How are things looking for elk hunters this year in the Cowboy State?
Well, like you mentioned, Wyoming is full of tremendous hunting opportunity in the fall. And one of the premier species that is certain to excite every hunter is elk. Elk hunting in Wyoming should be, once again, phenomenal. Our population numbers are abounding. Most areas in the state have very liberal seasons and rather high harvest success. And so, just a reminder to any Wyoming residents who are listening, there's still a chance for you to get an elk license. Wyoming residents can purchase a general elk license over the counter.
Question for you. You know, you heard for years that elk populations were being suppressed by the increase in wolves. And you heard that in Idaho, too. But if you talk to Idaho Fish and Game, they'll tell you actually elk numbers are quite healthy. Sounds like elk numbers are also pretty healthy in Wyoming from what you're saying. Are the wolves having less of an impact, or have the elk just adapted in terms of where they're going to protect themselves better?
Sure. So, you know, we only consider predation from wolves on elk in the western part of Wyoming where wolves' suitable habitat is. So it's definitely not a concern for us throughout the entire state. Elk populations are extremely healthy. Elk occur in every area of Wyoming. And so what is also cool about hunting in Wyoming, and not just elk, but there's, you know, diverse landscapes and diverse places where these big game species occur on the landscape. So when it comes to elk, you could be hunting in the west where they have those wolf packs that prey on elk, but throughout Wyoming, I mean, you could also be hunting in Red Desert where there's some phenomenal elk. You could be hunting over in the Laramie Peak area where there's phenomenal elk, or even up north in in the Bighorns, where there's a lot of great elk and great opportunities. So, you know, the numbers are remarkable. The populations in every region are above normal and above our standard. And so it should be a great hunt for anyone who pursues elk this fall.
All right, let's turn our attention to deer. You've got both mule deer, which I think most people associate with Wyoming. You've also got white-tailed deer, too. How is the hunting season looking for both of these species?
Like you mentioned, Wyoming offers mule deer and white-tailed deer hunting. Mule deer is sort of what people think about when they come to Wyoming, and so hunting for mule deer will be about the same as we've seen in the past couple years. We have had some localized impacts from mule deer from our winter storms. And so in certain areas of the state, those herds were impacted by the winter storms. And also in the Laramie area, some of those licenses were impacted by the Mullen fire. So there's still a lot of good opportunity for mule deer hunting. But if you're looking for a big trophy buck, might need to walk a little more and hunt a little harder, but hunters will be rewarded for their efforts that they put in. When it comes to whitetail hunting, whitetail populations are doing extremely well in Wyoming. Most whitetails are located in the, you know, Black Hills area, the northeast corner of the state, and also down in the Casper region. And those populations have been consistent for many years, and people should have a good hunt if they're pursuing whitetails. Another reminder for residents, we have a general deer license that's available for resident hunters, and they can buy that over the counter as well.
You're listening to Northwestern Outdoors Radio. We're talking to Sarah Dorenzo with Wyoming Game and Fish about the fall hunting forecast. Now, another species that gets a lot of attention in Wyoming, especially from out-of-state hunters, is the antelope or the pronghorn, whichever you want to call it, because Wyoming's probably the premier state to hunt pronghorn. How are populations looking this year?
Sure. Well, there's a reason that the pronghorn is featured on the Wyoming Game and Fish Department seal and logo. It's because it's iconic in the West. And so there's plenty of pronghorn throughout Wyoming. And license numbers were reduced this year due to the winter impacts and drought in some areas across the state. But there still is excellent public land hunting for pronghorn throughout Wyoming and lots of places that you could put a really nice sneak on a speed goat out on the landscape. Pronghorn were probably the most impacted this year by the drought that's facing the West. And so people should keep that in mind where they're out pursuing them. It's just very dry. So pronghorn and other big game really will be concentrated around water. So that means head to places that are more lush, head higher elevations because it's just been so hot and so dry. Animal patterning may be different than you remember from previous years, but follow the green, follow the water, and you should be in good shape.
Speaking of the drought and turning our attention to bird hunting, waterfowl hunting in Wyoming, you don't hear a bunch about it, but I'm guessing with the drought, you're probably not looking at a banner year for local duck hunting, are you?
No, not typically. Right now, you know, we know that waterfowl are susceptible to drought as well. And so hunters can expect to see a below average number of ducks across Wyoming. Their migration chronology is influenced by the weather. And so success for hunters will really depend on scouting efforts and maybe even getting permission to hunt on private land. But lots of water throughout Wyoming, especially in the refuge system that people can look to for waterfowl access and just know that you might see less ducks. But when it comes to something like geese, we anticipate the season to be very good.
Last but not least, upland birds. You certainly have lots of land to walk for sharp-tailed grouse. You've got some areas that are decent for pheasant, and you've certainly got forest grouse over in western Wyoming, too. Overall, how are things looking?
Well, yeah, once again, like everything else, upland birds can be impacted by drought as well because it reduces the cover and the forage that's available for them. So a little bit more walking this year when it comes to upland birds, but you can take good advantage of the variety of grouse species, chuckers, and partridges throughout the whole state. Once again, we're encouraging hunters to just head to wetter areas and higher elevations, and they should find more success in those areas.
All right, last question. This one's all about you, Sarah. What is your big hunt going to be this fall?
Oh, man. So I think I am doing a general deer hunt this year. I didn't put in for any limited quota licenses because I wasn't really sure what I wanted to do. And so I'm taking a break from pronghorn hunting, probably heading more into deer, but I'm certainly going to spend a lot of time bird hunting this fall.
Well, here is wishing you luck, and here's wishing everybody else luck who's tuning in today and plans on hunting in the Cowboy State this fall. As you heard, it's a bit of a mixed bag, but overall, especially for big game when it comes to deer and elk, looks like it's going to be a very good year. You can find out more about the statewide hunting forecast by going to the Wyoming Game and Fish website. You'll find a link right on the front page. Definitely worth checking out and reading and getting more information to plan your hunt this year in Wyoming. Sarah, always a pleasure to have you on Northwestern Outdoors Radio.
Thanks.
Sportsman's Warehouse is America's premier outfitter, and with over 90 locations, you're sure to find a store near you full of the gear you need to succeed this hunting season. Firearms, ammo, archery equipment, decoys, clothing, boots, and more. You'll find it all at Sportsman's Warehouse. Better still, the knowledgeable staff can help you with tips and frequent in-store seminars, all designed to help you bag a trophy or a limit this hunting season. Find a location near you or shop online today at sportsmanswarehouse.com.
Backcountry Hunters and Anglers is the voice for your public lands, waters, and wildlife. From the Canadian Yukon to the Florida Everglades, we're stepping up to conserve North America's public lands, defend our hunting and fishing traditions, and expand access to the outdoors. Find out how you can get involved at backcountryhunters.org.
Did you know we actually have a sponsorship opportunity available for this show? That's right. You can be a sponsor of Northwestern Outdoors Radio, reaching thousands of listeners every week, tuning in to 69 stations in 7 states. If you have a business that caters to outdoors enthusiasts, this is the platform for you, and you're going to find it's much more affordable than you think. Contact me through my website at northwesternoutdoors.com, and let's get a conversation started. That's northwesternoutdoors.com.
We're back with more of the great outdoors on Northwestern Outdoors Radio with John Cruz.
Yes, it is time for another Max Minute, brought to you every week by Max Lure. And with us again, he just can't stay away, is Bob Loomis. Bob, always a pleasure.
Thank you, John.
So, Bob, got a question. You know, there's a lot of paddle flashers on the market, and sometimes you can't find the right color. There's a go-to color for different fisheries in different places, and invariably, those get sold out really quick at sporting goods stores. However, I understand Max Lure has a little bit of a solution for that problem.
Well, John, you know, one of the things that we looked at is, you know, you can never have the right color of the day for what people are looking for. You know, the reason that we put silver on there is I always go back to the whole, my old scenario of, you know, commercial fishermen use silver Dodgers for a reason. And silver is a huge deal. But a lot of these colors that are out there today are for catching fishermen versus catching fish. But bottom line is, one thing that we came up with is here at the shop at Max Lure, we are selling all of our decals that we use for all of the different sling blades, double D Dodgers, all the sizes, as well as the paddle flashers. So you can order any of the decals that we've got and apply them to any of your sling blades, double Ds, or scent flash paddle flashers or triangles.
So let's say, for example, that a green flasher or a pink flasher or a chartreuse flasher is the hot one and they're sold out. You can literally just go to maxlure.com, order the decal of your choice, and just slap it right on your existing flasher and you're in business.
Absolutely.
I love this. Absolutely love this. All right, folks, the website to go to if you can't find the flasher with your color of choice is maxlure.com. Get yourself some decals for those Max Lure flashers you already have, and you will be able to match the flasher hatch.
game-changing. That's the best way to describe the new Scent Flash UV Triangle Flasher from Max Lure Company. This 360-degree rotational inline flasher features a scent release system attracting salmon to the lure behind it like no other flasher on the market. Soak the free scent pad with any type of oil or gel, or load up the cavity with any type of bait for fishing success beyond your wildest dreams. It's the Scent Flash UV Triangle Flasher, only from Max Lure Company.
Go fishing. Help salmon and make money. You can do it through September 30th by catching northern pike minnow and turning them in for cash. Here's how it works. First, register at a designated station on the Columbia or Snake River. Then, go fishing. At the end of the day, turn in any pike minnow you catch 9 inches or longer and look for the ones with tags worth $500. You'll get vouchers for those pike minnow you turn in, and you mail those in for cash. Find out more at pikeminnow.org.
Backcountry Hunters and Anglers is the voice for your public lands, waters, and wildlife. From the Canadian Yukon to the Florida Everglades, we're stepping up to conserve North America's public lands, defend our hunting and fishing traditions, and expand access to the outdoors. Find out how you can get involved at backcountryhunters.org.
You're back in with Northwestern Outdoors Radio. I'm John Cruz. We're going to have a really in-depth discussion about something very important today. It's about our summer steelhead. The run up the Columbia River this year is quite frankly horrendous. As a matter of fact, it's the worst recorded run since 1938, and this isn't a one-off. This is part of a continuing decline of an iconic fish that we treasure here in the Northwest. With us here to talk more about this issue is Josh Mills. He's an avid and well-known Northwest fly fisherman. He's a conservationist. He's a steelhead advocate. He works for Backcountry Hunters and Anglers, and he's also a board member with the Wild Steelhead Coalition. Josh, it is a pleasure to have you back on the air.
Thank you so much. Appreciate the opportunity to come and chat.
Let's start off with the fish that you and I both love, the summer steelhead. What do you love about these ocean-going rainbow trout, and why?
Oh, man, the answer is it's kind of like steelhead itself. It's so varied and so wide and so many different facets. You know, I love, you know, the fight. It's phenomenal. I love the rivers they inhabit. I love the time of year that we get to go chase them. I love their life histories and how they inhabit some crazy places. I love the camaraderie of my friends and my family and the tribe of people that we go chase these fish with, and just kind of creates a fabric of my life and the people around me come fall when, you know, typically they're available for me to fish for.
You know, I'm the same way. And I just have a hard time imagining the months of September and October, and even in some cases all the way through March, without fishing for summer steelhead east of the Cascade
right.
Mountain Range. Where do you like to fish for them? What are your favorite waters to fish for summer steelhead?
Well, you know, being a bit of a junkie, I'll travel far and wide. But the majority of my stuff down in the Lewiston-Clarkston Valley, down there in the LC Valley. So, you know, typically my program is on a normal year. As soon as there's enough fish over Lower Granite, you know, I caught them as early as July 7th.
Wow.
On the Clearwater. Yeah, a little bit crazy because then everything else just goes, well, I guess it's just steelhead season for the rest of the year. And I fished through them through the end of January. But then I spent a lot of time on that lower Clearwater, you know, the first 30 miles of the Clearwater up into Orofino and down. And then typically when the thermal block breaks on the Clearwater Snake at the confluence, where a lot of the fish, as you know, hit the confluence and the clear water's running at 52 to 55 degrees, then they do a lot of stray and use that as thermal refugia. And then as soon as that breaks, usually about the end of September, we start to migrate over, funny, bad pun, migrate over to the snake in the Grand Ronde system. And a lot of times I'll spend the majority of my time in October on the Grand Ronde, October and first parts of November. And then I spend a lot of time on the snake, which is wonderful because it's, you know, lots of access, a lot of ability to pick and choose your runs, share water with a lot of people, but not feel pressured and not feel crowded. It's quite nice.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, folks, if you're not familiar with steelhead fishing, these steelhead, they range anywhere from 4 to 6 pounds on a lot of the tributaries of the Columbia, all the way up to 20 pounds on the Clearwater. These are called the famous B-run fish that they have there at the hatchery. But I'm with you. I love some of these streams that you're talking about. I love fishing the Grand Ronde. I think my personal favorites are probably the Deschutes in Oregon. There's just something about fishing that classic river. And I used to love fishing the Wenatchee when that was a good river to fish, and the Methow River. You know, these smaller streams like the Grand Run, the Methow, the Wenatchee, there's something just very special about fishing these places where more than likely you're by yourself on the riverbank, picking apart a run and hopefully hooking into a couple of acrobatic summer steelhead. There's nothing that beats it.
No, and I have a lot of great memories, especially when the Methow was open, you know, in that 2009, 10, 11, 12 range when, God, I remember it was so good, you know, almost artificially good because, you know, you were mandatory four fish retention and they had game checkers on the hills watching with binoculars and stuff like that. But, you know, that was a different time when we had a different run, you know, and it's, you know, the intimacy of small water like the Grand Run, and certain people even love, you know, when things are right, like the Walla Walla or the Toucanon and, you know, some of those smaller intimate streams to these giant runs. Like, I remember when I first started fishing the Snake from the bank, and you just look at this giant piece of water running at 18,000 cubic feet a second or 20,000. Going, what do I do here?
Right,
and, you know,
right.
And learning how to section the water up and pick apart, you know, you just throw three quarters of the river away and be like, I'm never going to touch that. And, you know, and then you just bombs away with whatever method you choose, whether it's a spinning rod or a spay rod, it doesn't matter. And I've watched so many great stories happen in my life, whether it be my dad picking my pocket on the Clearwater last January, or, you know, my buddy Ryan catching his first fish, or my buddy, you know, I've lucky to be in with a lot of people who have, you know, caught their first fish. And like I was talking to somebody the other day, I was like, literally, I've seen so many people just like, it's like almost out of body experience when they land that first fish. They cease the ability to talk in cognitive sentences, you know, you got shaking hands and all this stuff. And it's such an iconic species for us as a culture. You know, it's Hope Springs renewal every fall when they come back. And it's just like, I'm having a real struggle this year because, you know, so much of the fabric of my fall and winter is enveloped around chasing these fish.
Absolutely. Folks, you're listening to Northwestern Outdoors Radio. We're talking steelhead with Josh Mills, a well-known Northwest fly fisherman, conservationist, and steelhead advocate. Let's talk about some of the factors that are affecting the steelhead runs.
Sure.
And we can break it down to several categories. Number one, hydro, that's the dams, hatcheries, habitat, the loss of which is really impacting fish. Harvest of fish, both, you know, recreationally and through commercial means and tribal means, and of course, predators too. We're going to start off with hydro. Now, Representative Mike Simpson in Idaho introduced a proposal to breach the four lower Snake River dams to restore steelhead runs to the Snake and Salmon Rivers and some of the tributaries there. I know you are an advocate of this, and so is Oregon Governor Kate Brown and several environmental organizations. But on the other hand, there's been unexpected opposition from people like Governor Jay Inslee, the Washington state senators who you thought would back this, and even some of the environmental organizations who don't like it. Tell us more about why you think breaching the Snake River dams is a good idea.
Well, you know, I think they've tried every single way potentially to try to find solutions that keep the dams in place. I mean, the fact of the matter is if we could recover and not have to take these dams out, I think more people would be for that. But the situation is that there's a multitude of factors at which the lower four Snake River dams are, you know, a good choice to think about removing. And first and foremost, we need to separate, which many people don't, is separate good dams from bad dams. And, you know, we have our main stem Columbia dams that are essential for power production and flood control and other things like that. The lower four Snake River dams were built explicitly for to make Lewiston and Clarkston the world's largest inland seaport as a delivery mechanism for grain and goods to sea, to the Port of Portland and the Port of Vancouver. And, you know, Lewiston, Clarkston and that port theory really never really came to fruition. And the electricity side, which a lot of people hang on as reasons why we need to do that, they're a boondoggle, to say the least, in terms of money we spend on them, the excess on the power grid that we have in a consistent manner. I mean, even at our highest in this last summer, and I'll paraphrase some of the data that I've seen, we didn't need the Snake River dams, and they're less than 4% of the power grid production capacity during the time when we had the extensive amount of 110 degree temperatures. They weren't using it. They were dumping the power and the electricity that came out of them. But back on more on the lines of salmon and steelhead and their ability, they're kind of the straw that are breaking the camel's back. And if you look at adult recruitment below the lower Forsnake River Dam. So rivers like the Klickitat, the Deschutes, and things like that, I believe it's called the SAR rate, are well above one. So it's like smolt to adult ratio, I believe it's called, are above one, because you have to have a fish to come back to replace the smolt that went downstream,
right?
In some cases. And the SAR rates above the lower Snake River dams are horrendous, way less than one, especially within the last 15 to 20 years and within the last 5 to 10 years.
Josh, I hate to cut you off here, but we are out of time for this segment. I would say this for folks who are listening. There are definitely arguments the other way, though, about, are we going to need more electricity in the future? And can the Snake River Dams provide that? What are going to be the economic factors if we breach the Snake River Dams in terms of transportation of goods downstream? But we're going to have to leave that for another time. I do want you to hang out for another segment, though, because I want to hit on some of the other issues that we're talking about. Can you hang past the commercial break?
100%.
All right, stick around, folks. We're going to be talking more steelhead on Northwestern Outdoors with Josh Mills in just a minute.
A sharp blade makes short work of any project you have in the outdoors, in the kitchen, or in the shop. Hone your knives and tools with quality power and manual sharpeners from Worksharp. Find out more at worksharptools.com.
Welcome back to Northwestern Outdoors Radio. I'm John Cruz. As promised, we're going to continue talking summer steelhead with Josh Mills, that very well-known Northwest fly fisherman, conservationist, and steelhead advocate. As we mentioned in the previous segment, we are looking at the worst run of summer steelhead up the Columbia and Snake River since 1938, and we're trying to figure out what the causes are and what we can do. Josh, great to have you back. Thanks for sticking around.
You betcha. Happy to talk.
So we just talked briefly about dams, and we could spend a whole hour talking about that, but I want to move on to some other issues, and one of them is hatcheries. Now, in the past, you and I think we'll both agree on this, biologists took this cookie-cutter approach, and they used the same strain of steelhead in hatcheries all over the Northwest, and it was disastrous, because what they found was these strains of steelhead didn't do as well as the native strains. Are we turning things around in terms of our hatchery production using brood stock programs and other means or not?
You know, you go from dams from a contentious issue to hatcheries as a super contentious issue. And so I'm jumping out of the pan into the fire or whatever that thing is, but hatcheries are, I think, a great struggle that we deal with within recovery of wild populations. And what, you know, I believe in and what a lot of the folks that I work with believe in is a basin-by-basin approach. There's going to be some places that hatcheries are absolutely necessary. We just don't have the habitat. We don't have the ability for fish and systems to recover in which to have the preponderance of larger runs. There are other places where we want to see and let wild fish do their thing, because it seems to me sometimes if we just get out of these fish's way a little bit within respects to hatcheries, they tend to come back a little bit better. You know, right now, the causes of what's happening on the Columbia and the Snake River system, they're not really a hatchery system problem. They're more widespread. I was looking at some graphs the other day, because one of the arguments is that, well, obviously we're getting less fish back because we're putting less hatchery fish into the system. Turns out that hatchery plants have been stable on the Columbia Snake almost within a very small variance. There isn't a drastic drop or anything like that in the last 20 years, and the adult survival rates have been plummeting. So there's something else going on. It's not so much a hatchery reform, although I would help. I think there's been advances in hatcheries and the ability to have a better play into that, whether it's, you know, better habitats that they're raised in or, you know, different things like that. I'm going to lean on the fact that I want more wild fish in the system rather than hatchery fish. But what we're dealing with right now is not specifically a hatchery issue.
Let's talk habitat real quick, because it's so easy for people to point the finger at dams and hatcheries. But, you know, I lived my formative years over in Western Washington, and my dad used to fish the Snoqualmie and the Tolt Rivers, tributaries of Puget Sound, and those runs have been destroyed. And it's plain and simple habitat destruction through development that caused this issue. And so you've got that, and yet now you have some efforts to try to reverse this on certain streams. But then you go out to the Olympic Peninsula, And these are streams that, by and large, the habitat has not been disturbed, but steelhead populations have also plummeted on the Olympic Peninsula. So what's the deal with habitat in these places?
You know, we have to make sure we separate the differences between the Olympic Peninsula and the Columbia, right? The Olympic Peninsula, of course, has this amazing fishery, has this, the quote of the last best place. Well, we're loving them to death over there hard. And it's not so much a habitat issue. And that's one of the things I was talking to somebody the other day. It was like, one of the reasons why steelhead are so enigmatic, so different. They're not like salmon. They're not these species of multitude. They live on the edges. They're very plastic, meaning they can, you know, colonize other rivers if necessary. There's no genetic difference between a steelhead and a rainbow, and you have the ability of these fish to repopulate, but they're very much on the margin. And part of their life histories is, you know, whether it's a fish that goes out to the ocean and spends 5 years or goes out and spends 6 months. Or you've got fish that are, you know, can repopulate with a resident rainbow trout and stuff. So you have all these different links in the chain that cause all this together. But on the Olympic Peninsula, it's an issue of, you know, we got a real problem with overfishing because of, you know, we filled the stoke and told people how amazing that place is over there and how big the fish are. And then, you know, you have times where sport fishery is a heavy impact. But, you know, we'd be remiss to say that, you know, there are some netting issues over there. There's some over harvest issues. There's poaching issues over there that has caused a lot of those streams to miss their escapement goal for the better half of a decade.
Let's talk a little bit about netting, and I sometimes fear to do this because I always get some feedback when I do, but let's talk gill nets and in two different ways. You know, the gill nets that are out there, 15% are commercial gill net operations in Lower Columbia River. Back almost 10 years ago now, there was an agreement between the states of Oregon and Washington to reform gill netting and basically get those out of the main channels. The Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife has walked that back with Governor Inslee's support, and we still see gill netting going on. In addition to that, we definitely have a lot of tribal netting going on. They're primarily targeting Chinook salmon on the Columbia River, but they're certainly getting a lot of steelhead as well. How much of a factor is gill netting to our steelhead runs?
Well, what we know, regardless of who puts the nets in, is that gill nets are indiscriminate killers. And so, you know, when you have a ESA-listed wild-born, two-salt bee run coming up the main stem Columbia, it doesn't care who put that net in. If it gets in it and it dies, it dies. And you're going to have a lot of incidental contact with those things. You really have a political quagmire a lot of the times. I think it's absolutely insane that we have commercial gill netting on a river with ESA-listed fish within the commercial realm. You know, we have to respect the tribal sovereignty of the tribes to be able to do what they would like to do in terms of their methods of fishing. And that is their right under the Bolt decision. So, you know, I can't really comment too much on that. I can tell you is what I hope is that we have more collaboration between the tribes, the states, and everything like that to really realize that we've got to find a better way. Because if we're continuing to scrape a large percentage of our run into nets, and I don't know how many are actually getting in there, and you are 100% correct, those nets are designed for Chinook, but it doesn't matter. You're going to have some steelhead that get caught in them. I would point to the Lower Columbia, but in a collaboration by a couple of environmental groups and states, they brought back this old technology called a pound net on the Lower Columbia. If you search Lower Columbia pound net on the Google machine, you'll see this system that it was banned and outlawed actually in the late 1800s and early 1900s on the Columbia because it was too effective.
Oh, wow.
What it is, it puts a lead out into a little farther in the channel because these fish don't run straight up the middle. They run on the edges. They run to try to go the path of least resistance. So it's these leads of net of a, kind of a wall, but not like a gill net, kind of like a mesh, right? So it causes these fish to turn and it kind of creates this like circle and it pushes them into a retainment area. So then a person can come in and sort the fish without them being stuck in a gill net. So it's just like this person goes down into the whole retention area. They can sort left, you know, okay, here's a hatchery Chinook, bonk that. Here's a wild steelhead, let it go. And so you're sorting and understanding that these fish, you know, you can take these fish that are there for the taking, but you let go of the ones that don't need to be.
Right.
And I'm really hopeful that we can get a little more adoption of that because I think that's the future of that. I mean, we just can't have commercial gill nets in the river. And I would hope, again, the tribes that, you know, maybe can pull back on some of that stuff, especially in these times of really, really poor return. It's a tragedy of the commons because everybody wants to keep doing what they want to do. And it seems like nobody wants to pull back.
And you're right. Nobody wants to give up catching the last fish, and that is a tragedy. We didn't even get to predation, and we're talking not just pike minnow, folks. We're talking about smallmouth bass. We're talking walleye. We're talking terns. We're talking cormorants. We're talking seals. We're talking sea lions. We'll have to leave that discussion for another time.
Absolutely. I will tell you, John, real quick, you know what's delicious? Smallmouth bass tacos from the Columbia and the Snake River. So I'll leave it at that.
All right, Josh, we have got to go. But folks, if you're concerned about this issue, and you should be, consider joining one of the many organizations out there that are advocating for steelhead in the Pacific Northwest. There's a lot of them, whether it's Trout Unlimited or the Coastal Conservation Association, Northwest Steelheaders, the Wild Steelhead Coalition, Backcountry Hunters and Anglers, and a whole bunch more. Pick one that speaks to you. Consider joining them. Consider reaching out to your representatives. Let them know that you do not want our iconic steelhead to go away and you want them to be saved. Josh, thanks for the thought-provoking conversation today on Northwestern Outdoors Radio.
Thank you for having me, sir.
Located in the northeast corner of Oregon, Wallowa County offers a unique destination rich in natural beauty and outdoors recreation. Enjoy the clear waters of Wallowa Lake. Take a tram to the top of Mount Howard for million-dollar views. Hike or ride into the Eagle Cap Wilderness and fish or raft the Wallowa and Grand Ronde Rivers. It's all waiting for you in beautiful Wallowa County. Plan your visit today at WallowaCountyChamber.com. That's WallowaCountyChamber.com.
Go fishing, make money, help out, and have fun. That's what the Northern Pike Minnow Sport Reward Fishery is all about. From May 1st through September 30th, catch pike minnow out of the Columbia and Snake Rivers and turn them in for cash. Pike minnow eat juvenile salmon and steelhead. Each one you catch helps more juvenile fish reach the ocean. Pike minnow are worth anywhere from $5 to $8, and keep an eye out for tagged fish worth $500. Find out more at pikeminnow.org and go fishing.
Did you know we actually have a sponsorship opportunity available for this show? That's right. You can be a sponsor of Northwestern Outdoors Radio, reaching thousands of listeners every week, tuning in to 69 stations in 7 states. If you have a business that caters to outdoors enthusiasts, this is the platform for you, and you're going to find it's much more affordable than you think. Contact me through my website at northwesternoutdoors.com, and let's get a conversation started. That's northwesternoutdoors.com.
Sportsman's Warehouse is America's premier outfitter and has what you need as a hunter, angler, hiker, paddler, camper, and outdoors enthusiast. They also carry an extensive assortment of firearms and ammunition you simply can't find anymore at many big box stores. On top of that, their knowledgeable staff is here to help you purchase the right gear so you can get the most out of your outdoor experience. Visit your local Sportsman's Warehouse store today or shop online anytime at sportsmans.com.
We've got time for one more shot of Northwestern Outdoors Radio with John Cruz.
I'm glad you're back for our final segment of the show, and hopefully we've gotten you motivated to do some stuff outdoors today. One thing I love doing in September, upland bird hunting. Whether it be dove hunting, which has been open since the 1st in most of the Northwest, or grouse hunting, which has also been open in much of the Northwest and actually opens up the 15th in Washington, there's something to be said for walking a Forest Service road or a trail or maybe across the prairies looking for ruffed grouse or sharp-tailed grouse, especially with a dog with you. It's always so much fun. Now, personally, I love to hunt with a 20-gauge shotgun. I've got a couple I like to use. My favorite is a CZ Mallard over and under shotgun. Absolutely love it. Actually gave it to my daughter a few Christmases ago, but now and again, she'll loan it to dear old dad to use for old time's sake. My other shotgun is a Browning BPS 20 gauge. Absolutely love it. I have shot a lot of quail, a lot of grouse, a few chucker, and even some pheasant with that shotgun over the years. And if you are looking for a quality upland bird shotgun, I would steer you towards your local Sportsman's Warehouse store. They've got a great selection of shotguns for upland birds and waterfowl and more. And they've also got the ammunition you need too, not to mention those blaze orange vests that upland bird hunters need, and dog accessories too. You'll need those for the dogs if you're hunting this September. And one other thing you'll want to have, a good pair of boots. And they've got a great selection of boots, both for hiking and hunting at Sportsman's Warehouse stores. So go check them out. Get ready to enjoy the fall upland bird season. Get out there and do so. You're going to love it. And now it's time for your Sportsman's Warehouse trivia question of the week. And it's about the steelhead, which we've been talking about during the show. One of the states here in the greater Northwest actually has the steelhead as their state fish. And that's your question. What state is it? If you think you know the answer, and I know a lot of you do, just go to our Facebook page at Northwestern Outdoors Radio. If you haven't already, please like and follow that page. Then look for the post thread where we've got the question. Give us your answer there. If you don't do Facebook, go to our website at northwesternoutdoors.com. Shoot us an email with the answer to the question, which state has the steelhead as their state fish here in the greater Northwest. One lucky person who gets this right wins that $25 gift card we give away every week from Sportsman's Warehouse. We are completely out of time, so until next time, do take care, God bless, and make it a point to spend some time outdoors.